Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. To all the world, the American withdrawal from Afghanistan looks like a tragic, chaotic debacle. But President Biden is staunchly defending his administration, as he did with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
So you don't think this could have been handled, this actually could have been handled better in any way? No mistakes?
No, I don't think it could have been handled in a way that we're going to go back in hindsight and look. But the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing, I don't know how that happens. I don't know how that happened.
So for you, that was always priced into the decision?
Yes.
Ryan Crocker, let me start with this. Was this operation, this withdrawal, the right thing to do now?
No.
Okay. Daniel Silverberg, same question for you. Was this withdrawal the right thing to do now?
Yes.
Well, Ryan Crocker was U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2011 to 2012. In 2002, he reopened the U.S. embassy in Kabul. He was also ambassador to Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He joins me from Spokane, Washington. Ambassador Crocker, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me, Daniel.
And Daniel Silverberg was the national security advisor to House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, majority counsel to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He also worked on counterterrorism issues at the Department of Defense and now co-leads the national security team at the consultancy Capstone LLC. Daniel Silverberg, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so Daniel Silverberg, let me start with you. You recently wrote in The Atlantic that you believe that President Biden made the best of a bad situation. You said he faced a bad set of options, ultimately made the difficult but necessary choice to preserve American lives, that he did not decide to withdraw so much as chose to acknowledge a long festering reality. Tell me more.
Sure. And let me start off with two disclaimers or acknowledgments. One, it really is such an honor to be on this program, both with you and with Ambassador Crocker, who has such a distinguished career and really one of our finest diplomats of the last half century. And also, it's tough to assert that this was the right decision while we are seeing such horrific images from the Kabul airport. It's heartbreaking. But that said, I still do think it was the right decision for the following reasons. First, I was driven to write that piece in The Atlantic because I felt pretty adamantly we never controlled Afghanistan. And having been on the congressional side of this war for 14 years and having been a recipient of any number of briefings and hearings and materials from the Department of Defense, it became increasingly and frustratingly clear that there was a huge gulf between how our military and intelligence personnel were characterizing the situation on the ground and what was actually happening. And unfortunately, that's what we see playing out today. We did not have control. And as a result, that meant that this was going to be chaotic. And if one puts themselves in the shoes of the president, and if I were a staffer in the White House, of course, I wish that they had started moving special, called SIVs, special immigrant visas. But the folks who helped us, these heroes, of course I wish that they had started the evacuations earlier. But you put yourself in the shoes of the president who is being told he had plenty of time to get this done. And unfortunately, that was not the case.
Well, Ambassador Crocker, you were recently quoted in your hometown newspaper, The Spokesman Review in Spokane. In that article, we're reminded that President Biden, when in 2002, after you reopened the U.S. embassy in Kabul, that President Biden was the first U.S. lawmaker to visit there. And yet today you're saying that you're left with some grave questions about his ability to lead the nation as commander in chief. Tell me more.
It hasn't been a brilliant initial step onto the national security stage for President Biden. And quite frankly, his efforts to explain it subsequently have been anything except convincing. And I guess we have another effort by him today. Now, let me just back up a sec. I mean, you mentioned 2002 when I reopened the embassy. And Mr. Silverberg has spoken of U.S. control. We didn't have that kind of control. Well, first, we had no ambiguity about why we went into Afghanistan. It was a response to 9/11. Our strategic aim was to ensure that Afghan soil was never again used for such attacks. And we felt it deeply. You know, 6 months after 9/11, we commemorated the burial of a piece of the World Trade Center under the flagpole at the embassy in Kabul. So it has always been about national security. And it was also about the Afghans themselves moving in to take the lead. You're right. We never controlled Afghanistan. Well, we never tried, and I'm very glad we didn't. Unlike Iraq, where we were a formal occupier, that was not the case in Afghanistan. So I think these are fundamentally important points. It is about national security, and I'm afraid that President Biden has just put our national security in jeopardy.
Okay. So, but tell me more about why you lay that currently at the feet of President Biden, given the fact that it doesn't, your line is a little shaky, Ambassador, so forgive me if I misheard you, but it doesn't sound like you do that you disagree with the fact that, as Daniel Silverberg is saying, that we never really fully had control of Afghanistan.
That is absolutely correct. We didn't seek it. When I arrived just after New Year's 2002, I took a look at the laydown of our forces in Afghanistan. We only had one single conventional combat unit, which was a Marine Expeditionary Unit and its battalion landing team. That was it for the whole country. So we didn't seek control. We didn't want control. The international community didn't go that way. The Bonn Conference of December 2001 and named Hamid Karzai as the chairman of the Afghan Interim Authority. So from the beginning, we supported the fledgling institutions of Afghanistan. We didn't try to turn it into a zone of occupation.
And so that has been going on for many years, as both of you are saying. And why, though, now are you saying that you do not have confidence in President Joe Biden's abilities as commander in chief?
What his decision and the forces he set in motion have done were to bring the Taliban back. This would be the Taliban that ran Afghanistan until 2001. The Taliban under which al-Qaeda sheltered and had the space and the security to plan the 9/11 attacks. Well, what President Biden has done, inadvertently, of course, is to put the band back together. They're back. The Taliban is back. Al-Qaeda will be back with them. So this is not hypothetical. These groups struck into the American homeland, and now they're back running Afghanistan. So we are in a position of real jeopardy here. And further, again, looking at the larger strategic picture, not only has the Taliban and al-Qaeda come back, we're also looking at a situation in which our ability to monitor what they do our intelligence capabilities are degraded because we're not going to be there anymore. And Bill Burns, the CIA director, has already spoken to that. So it's very hard to see how we can style this as a successful step in making America safer.
Yeah. Well, the phone line is a bit of a challenge right now, Ambassador. So during the break, we're going to try and get you on a better line. But Daniel Silverberg, let me ask you, if memory serves, it was the Trump administration that chose to negotiate with the Taliban and pretty much left the Afghan government meaningfully out of the picture there. So do you disagree with Ambassador Crocker's assessment that it's Joe Biden's actions that brought the Taliban back?
I do disagree with, again, humility that Ambassador Crocker is he had tremendous experience on the ground and great diplomatic perspective. But I disagree quite vehemently. One, this was not Joe Biden who brought the band back together. When the Secretary of State in the last year appears with the head of the Taliban, that's about as legitimizing an action as one can get. That was not this president. That was the previous administration. And that administration also committed the United States to a withdrawal. And I've heard a lot of talk of, well, the Biden administration could have easily reversed that. You don't easily reverse a decision where you have essentially legitimized a foreign adversary. And there was no way that decision was going to be reversed with a mere 2,500 troops. So that's first. Second, the idea that we did not seek control of the country, I think the Taliban perspective is pretty significant here. And I don't speak Dari or Pashto. I admit I am not an expert on what the Taliban are thinking, but I feel pretty confidently in saying they perceived our forces on the ground as occupiers, whether that was 2,500 forces or in 2010, upwards of 100,000. So the idea that we did not, our intent was not to seek occupation, I think is irrelevant here. The question is, how did the Taliban see us and what were the facts on the ground?
Well, today we are talking about what we're seeing in Afghanistan and whether the American exit could have gone better. What would have had need to be different? And what can change now in order to manage the humanitarian disaster going on in Afghanistan? Hop on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio and let us know what you think. We'll be back with a lot more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking with decorated former diplomat Ryan Crocker, who was ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and Pakistan and several other countries for many decades. Daniel Silverberg is also with us as well. He worked on counterterrorism and national security, both at the Pentagon and in Congress. And we're discussing whether what we're seeing unfolding on the ground in Afghanistan, the chaos and the catastrophe, whether that was really inevitable. And let's listen to, for a moment, to three-star General H.R. McMaster, who, of course, at one time served as National Security Advisor under President Donald Trump. And he spoke this week with journalist Barry Weiss on her podcast, and McMaster had some very strong words for his colleagues in the Trump administration. He said that U.S. Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad made Neville Chamberlain look good. And this is what he had to say about former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Our Secretary of State signed a surrender agreement to the Taliban. And do you know what happened next? The Taliban began to marshal weapons and fighters. They left Pakistan, began to marshal for a major offensive, timed for about this time, right? Planned well in advance. And then what they did is they went to Afghan commanders at various levels and said, hey, here's your alternatives. The Americans already told you they're abandoning you. So either we can come to an agreement, you know, where we'll give you some pay, we'll give you free passage and everything. Or the alternative is we're going to kill you and your families. How about that for a deal? And so that's why you saw the collapse. This collapse goes back to the capitulation agreement of 2020. I mean, the Taliban didn't defeat us. We defeated ourselves.
Three-star General H.R. McMaster and former National Security Advisor under President Trump. He was on Barry Weiss's podcast. Ambassador Crocker, respond to that.
Well, first, I would agree with Daniel before the break. This did not start with President Biden and President Trump's decision to acquiesce in the Taliban's longstanding demand that it would talk to the United States, but not with the American puppet in the room. When he conceded that point, and I said this publicly at the time, that told us what these talks were about. They were not about peace. They were about an American capitulation and getting out of the country. So no question, President Biden was dealt a very bad hand. But then he played the cards he got, I think, again, very poorly to withdraw in the precipitate fashion he did has led to the chain reactions we see now. And I'm particularly disturbed by the way he blamed the Afghans themselves, and particularly the security forces. One quick anecdote. When I was ambassador, once a week, there was a brief solemn ceremony at National Security Assistance Headquarters in which the names of the dead, of the killed in action, were read aloud. There were always a few Americans, at least a few, and it was painful for me to listen to that. Other coalition members spoke about their losses. The last speaker was the Afghan military representative. He did not read any names. He read a number, 133, 157. That was the number of Afghan National Security Forces who had been killed. So to say they didn't have the stomach for the fight, or they weren't in the fight, that is just horrible. So, again, President Trump put us on the road to hell here, but President Biden certainly made it no better, if anything worse.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that there are basically several stages that we can look at of American decision-making that led to this moment. And it's almost as if I want to work backwards with the two of you on those stages. So there's the decision of President Biden to perpetuate the Trump administration's policy. That's sort of where we are now. There's the errors that we're talking about with the Trump administration itself. And then, quite frankly, for years prior to that, maybe as the American people could have been asking for more sort of honest reporting or frank assessments to the public about what was happening on the ground in Afghanistan. But Daniel Silverberg, presidents get to inherit the legacy of both good and bad decisions made by the administrations before them. And at the same time, a new president gets to also choose the people that he or she wants to represent them in America's best interests. I hear what you're saying about it being difficult to change tack from how the path that the Trump administration set the United States on. But Joe Biden could have chosen someone else other than Zalmay Khalilzad to lead that. That was his prerogative. Was it a mistake to not do that?
I don't think so, Meghna. I think that the president had concluded in this regard, similar to the previous administration, that after 2 decades of fighting in Afghanistan, we were going to accomplish as much as we could. And I agree with Ambassador Crocker that everyone was focused on the fact this was a national security mission at heart. That national security mission had really been accomplished in 2011, and yet we perpetuated in armed conflict there for another decade. And by Defense Department estimates, we were getting weaker. The Taliban was getting stronger. And so I think yes, the president was dealt a bad hand, but I also think that he made a strong decision. And this is what I argued in my article, that he did what I think for our national security was critical to do in stemming the bleeding in Afghanistan. And this is a key point where I would disagree strongly with General McMaster. Whenever I hear the word appeasement, having worked on Capitol Hill for 14 years, that immediately makes me sense this issue is being politicized. There was no appeasement here on anyone's part. There was a cold, clear-eyed national security calculation that was made. And if anything, I know as national security professionals, we're supposed to not be emotional here, but like Ambassador Crocker, I also get emotional on this. I get emotional about the fact that for years, generals were coming to Capitol Hill and crossing a line from providing objective information to salesmanship, and I think overstating strongly what was actually happening in Afghanistan. And I think President Biden looked at that fact, looked at what we could actually accomplish there. Was it in our interests? And made the decision of saying enough.
Well, if he looked at that fact that they were overstating things strongly, how could he say that he was caught off guard by how rapidly things fell apart?
Well, that is an eminently fair question. And if I were in the White House, I think that I'm confident that there is ample hand-wringing taking place. But I think he was caught off guard because the estimates he was being given, when he said we are going to withdraw, we are going to have a number of months here, the estimates he was being given were telling him that he had time. That's what the director of national intelligence confirmed yesterday. That's what General Milley said, that he was receiving unequivocal, unambiguous assessments that he would have time to effect an evacuation. And those assessments were wrong. And they were reflective of, I think, 2 decades worth of, frankly, bad intelligence perspective on Afghanistan.
Well, let's listen to what Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, both under Trump and Biden, said just in May to members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He told the House Committee that the Afghan army would hold its own after U.S. troops withdrew.
I personally believe that the statements that the forces will disintegrate and the Talibs will take over in short order are mistaken. The real choices that the Afghans will face is between a long war and a negotiated settlement.
Ambassador Crocker, is this part of the problem? This years of I don't know if I should call it direct misinformation or lack of candor, at least, about the situation on the ground?
Megna, I can't speak to that in current time. Obviously, I'm not there. I certainly sensed or knew that at the time when I was there, the U.S. military and the U.S. State Department, neither were gilding any lilies. I think we were pretty clear at the time of the challenges we continued to face. But we also have to note here that it wasn't a steady state thing with respect to security conditions and numbers of U.S. troops. When I left Afghanistan in 2012, we were at the peak of the surge, about 100,000 troopers on the ground in Afghanistan. The Taliban controlled the old provincial capitals. We steadily drew that number down when President Obama left office. We had a little over 10,000. And still, the Taliban controlled no provincial capitals. So if you're looking at this as a diagram, you see the sharply dropping line of U.S. combat forces in country against a steady line of the Taliban not being able to take and hold ground. So, again, by the time President Biden made his announcement, we really were at a status quo that I think was sustainable and a pretty cheap insurance policy against a retaking of the country by the forces that brought us 9/11.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to, again, from late May of this year. This is in the Senate Armed Services Committee, and they held a hearing on U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. And Ranking Member Republican James Inhofe of Oklahoma said that he thought that President Biden's choice of September 11th as the withdrawal date was a mistake.
The fact that the president chose this date, the 20th anniversary of the most horrific terrorist attacks in our nation's history, indicates this was a calendar-based political decision. It was not based on conditions on the ground. This isn't just my interpretation. An unnamed senior administration official told the Washington Post, quote, "The president has judged that a conditions-based approach is a recipe for staying in Afghanistan forever." Now, I'm troubled by that statement.
Daniel Silverberg, do you want to respond to that? Because indeed, Senator Inhofe there pointing out truth that, you know, it was President Joe Biden that said ultimately his end date for U.S. troops in Afghanistan was September 11th.
Sure. I think you're right to distinguish between two questions here. One is, was it the right decision to withdraw forces generally from Afghanistan? And then in the proximate term, was it the right decision to do it right now in the way that it happened? And I think those two points get easily confounded, and I think the observations that we need to be observing conditions on the ground before withdrawing certainly conflate those two. This is what I think is the clear point we have now on Afghanistan, which Fareed Zakaria articulated pretty poignantly yesterday. It was not a decision of do we have zero troops on the ground or do we have 2,500 as an insurance policy. The question was, do you have zero or do you have a surge to defend U.S. interests there? And in order to maintain some element of control or affect the conditions on the ground, as Senator Inhofe referenced, you would need upwards of 13,000 forces to do that. We were not going to be able to merely hold territory with 2,500. Should the president have surged forces earlier? Well, again, that goes back to the estimate that he thought he had more time here. Obviously, we know now he didn't. But the idea of looking exclusively at conditions on the ground, I think, is a way of saying, well, we could have kept forces there for a lot longer. And that was just not the case. And Meghna, I want to make one other point here at risk of sounding partisan, but I think it's really important for people to recognize. Our own domestic politics also had an impact here, meaning let's say the president did everything that people said he should have, that he started the SIV evacuation earlier, that he had troops on the ground earlier to effect an orderly withdrawal. Where exactly were those SIVs going to go? For 14 years, I had seen the immigration debate on Capitol Hill become so partisan, polluted, terrible, that as late as 2 months ago, Republicans were still resisting bringing SIVs to this country. Democrats were trying to negotiate a bill called the Allies Act to increase the number of SIVs, similar debate that had taken place any number of times in the Defense Authorization Bill. They kept resisting. And so this idea that somehow if only the president had had the gumption and the fortitude to send in planes and bring people here, I don't think comports with the reality of our own domestic politics.
Ambassador Crocker, what do you think about that?
Well, there's a little phrase in American politics, show me where my people are going so I can lead them. And that's what I think we have more than a little of right now with President Biden's decision. Instead of taking the bully pulpit, for example, to explain to the American people why our continuing presence in Afghanistan was essential, critical to our national security, and to lay out a plan for achieving that. Again, with respect to troops on the ground and roles and missions, we have not been in a direct combat role for several years now. We've been doing advising, some logistics, and of course, air support. So it's an incorrect assertion to say that we would have to go to X number of forces to be able to prevail here. Well, again, we had a status quo, less than perfect, certainly knows, but a very affordable insurance policy, I thought, to prevent the Taliban and their Al-Qaeda associates being in a position to do what they did to us on 9/11.
Well, as we head into the break, listener Sam sent us this tweet that Trump and Pompeo made a deal with the Taliban, didn't ask for Afghan input, released 5,000 Taliban prisoners, and refused Biden transition briefings. That's from an On Point listener on Twitter. And it brings to mind that back in November of 2020, CNN reported that the then Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, he had sent a classified memo to the White House asserting that it was the unanimous recommendation of the chain of command that the U.S. not withdraw its troop presence in Afghanistan until certain conditions had been met. Reduction of violence, a credible pledge from the Taliban to renounce al-Qaeda. By the way, that memo was endorsed by the head of U.S. CENTCOM and the head of the NATO mission in Afghanistan. President Trump then soon after fired Mark Esper as Secretary of Defense. So there are so many layers of detail in history. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about what would need to have been different regarding the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, to have avoided the chaos that we're seeing in Afghanistan these days, and whether or not even hoping for that is a fool's errand. Would the chaos have been inevitable? I'm joined today by Ambassador Ryan Crocker, and Daniel Silverberg is also with us. Let's listen to a little bit more of what President Biden has been saying in his speech to the American people on Monday. Biden said things did not go as well as planned, but he still believes he did the right thing.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risks. We planned for every contingency, but I always promised the American people that I would be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated.
President Joe Biden on Monday. And here's On Point listener Tim, who called us from Las Vegas. He's a Navy veteran and participated in Operation Anaconda. And this is what he had to say about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Is it bad? Of course. Was there a better way to do it? No. Not unless you think of an exit strategy before you get in. The days of just starting a war and saying, well, we trained them and then leaving it up to them doesn't work anymore. You need an actual strategy to lead. We didn't have that.
Daniel Silverberg, do you want to respond to that? I mean, Tim's saying that things would have had to have been different from 2002 onwards.
Thank you. That sounds condescending. I just feel so deeply for all of the men and women in uniform who spent years in Afghanistan and are watching this unfold. And not just our uniform personnel, but our State Department, AID, and other government personnel who literally gave life and limb for the national security mission Ambassador Crocker mentioned. And I think it's important to acknowledge that because anything we're saying is in that context. I agree with that assessment of that there was an element going back to 2002 of not having a clear exit strategy. I can't tell you how many congressional briefings I participated in where we would hear all kinds of somewhat outlandish, creative, and far-fetched ideas on how the Afghan strategy was going to be put back on the tracks. Everything from Donna Karen opening up a wool production facility to tech delegations going over a mine exploration operation in the middle of a war. To me now, probably the most eye-raising something called the Afghan Infrastructure Fund, where the United States gave billions to construct massive projects that were utterly unsustainable and which the special inspector on Afghanistan, Sagar, concluded was an unmitigated disaster. So I flag all that to say that, yes, we needed to have a better strategy. It's far easier to say that in hindsight, but there were any number of exit ramps that could have been taken, such as the 2011 negotiations that were unfortunately stymied.
Indeed. Okay. So there were a number of exit ramps, as you've been putting it, for the past 20 years. But Ambassador Crocker, let me turn back to you and let's focus on this past year, for example. I mean, what could have been done once the fait accompli of U.S. troops being withdrawn, you know, it had been decided? What could have been done differently to avoid the sheer chaos that we are seeing now? Could there have been a smoother last days of a U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
Certainly, there could have been and should have been, Digna. The Afghan security forces were not configured and in no way prepared for the Taliban surge. They were in that position because that's the army we wanted to build for Afghanistan, one patterned on our own, heavily reliant on air support, both kinetic and logistic, and for medevacs. With our precipitate withdrawal, of course, we took our Air Force contractors with us, and suddenly the Afghan security forces were left with a model military, if you will, that was completely unsustainable. So my point is that we could have had, should have had, a detailed consultation with the Afghan government to get ready for, this is what we're going to do, a complete U.S. withdrawal and to take their views into account. And indeed, right after the administration came into office, like literally day one, Jake Sullivan called his counterpart in Kabul and then put out a statement saying that he had reached out to say that the new administration is in place. We appreciate all we've done with our Afghan allies. We look forward to a period of consultation now to talk about next steps. Mm. And then that was immediately repudiated by Tony Blinken's letter to President Ghani. And by the way, secretaries of state don't address correspondence to chiefs of state. Basically took the Afghans to task for all they didn't do and then
said, and zero is very definitely an option. So it was almost a hostile U.S. withdrawal, leaving the turnover at Bagram. There really was no turnover at Bagram. We left, and there the Afghans were watching us go. So we should have had consultations with our NATO allies, who are furious with us. They had a big stake in this as well. So diplomacy versus defense, I was very cheered to hear as a career foreign service officer most of my life, the president say, we're going to put our weight on diplomacy. Well, where are we now? We've plussed up on defense with about 6,000 troops back in country now and shrunk our embassy down to a tiny handful.
Right.
So if withdrawal was a decision, which I certainly would not have supported, there was a lot of scope to make that far more orderly withdrawal than what we're seeing. Look, I'm on the board of No One Left Behind. I just want to say this because it's important. Our whole mission is getting those who served us to safety. And it's been an excruciating piece of process. You can go into that later. But my mailbox is filled up every single day with desperate pleas for help from some of these people whose lives are literally on the line right now. That should never have happened. That is a
right.
We let these people down.
Yeah, so Ambassador Crocker, I didn't mean to jump in there, but I want to turn to Daniel Silverberg, because we're getting a lot of comments from our listeners about exactly this. Because the one thing, you know, rather than relitigating 20 years worth of decision-making across multiple administrations, the one thing that inescapably the Biden administration is responsible for is exactly what Ambassador Crocker is saying. Like, a listener named Daniel R.W. is saying, I can't comprehend why we couldn't start mass evacuations of at-risk groups, including those who worked with the U.S. military, months before we pulled out. Why all the bureaucracy surrounding refugees? It's such a nightmare. Why is this also haphazard and last minute? Does the administration just not care? Daniel Silverberg, your response to that.
Sure. And again, I think you're right to distinguish between that long-term question of should we have withdrawn and then how it was done. And then on that initial question of should we have withdrawn, I think it's important to cite General Petraeus here, 2011, saying, of course we need to leave. We cannot be perceived as an occupying force. There needs to be a time in which we leave, and that time should be made very clear. So I think President Biden was doing that in this instance. But the question of how we withdrew here, in hindsight and with some perspective, I'm sure there will be any number of questions answered on what exactly went wrong with the intelligence assessment here. But I really think it goes back to that the White House thought they had more time and they didn't. But again, let's say that we did have – let's say the White House did have more time and tried to do this more efficiently. One, could we have brought those SIVs to the U.S. sooner? And because of the political dynamics I mentioned, I don't think so. And two, we need our allies to take Afghan refugees in order to stage them and then bring them to the United States. Hmm. Our allies, their politics on immigration are no cleaner or easier than ours are. In fact, we almost saw the German government collapse in 2015. They are struggling right now to get their own people and their own Afghan helpers out of the country. And I think if they are not able to take thousands of refugees during a crisis, because we all know that countries don't really undertake difficult decisions unless they're in a crisis. I saw the same thing on Capitol Hill. Things did not happen unless you were up against a deadline. If they are not affecting that kind of evacuation now, I just don't see how would we be able to have cleanly negotiated our way into evacuating thousands of refugees under normal circumstances.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Daniel Silverberg, former advisor on national security and counterterrorism affairs, both at the Pentagon and in Congress, now co-leads the national security team at the consultancy Capstone LLC. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Ambassador Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and many more, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Honor. Ryan Crocker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again, Megan.
Khaled Hosseini is a world-renowned novelist, author of bestsellers The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. He was born in Afghanistan but left the country as a young man. His novels focus on the Afghanistan he knew growing up, before the warlords, before the Islamist militias, before the Russians, the Pakistanis, and yes, before the Americans made his country into a forever battlefield. Hosseini now lives in California, and he told us that despite all the negatives that came with American and allied occupation, he saw his country healing. That ended this week.
This week has been very painful for me. I grew up in Afghanistan in an era that was, I think to most people's mind, is hard to believe. A peaceful Afghanistan where children could have a happy childhood. I certainly had one. It's a very, very different place. And to see the Taliban flag flying over my birthplace is very painful. I've always had a deep personal, emotional bond with the country. Every time I entered into Afghan airspace and I look down and I see those beautiful mountains, those endless, endless mountain ranges down below, I feel a tug. I feel like I'm returning to a piece of myself I left behind decades before. And to see that beautiful land and those beautiful people, and now the start of what appears to be another bleak era, it's a lot to take. It's very, very painful. I'm worried for people who worked to preserve human rights in Afghanistan, the brave and the resilient and resourceful women who served in the government, who became police chiefs, who became provincial governors, who became mayors, who advanced the cause for Afghan women, the brave girls who went to school despite the threats of the insurgents, who attacked them in all sorts of abhorrent ways. I feel their pain, I feel their frustration, I feel their anxiety, and I feel their fear. The country that the Taliban have conquered now is not the country that they left. You know, a lot has happened in Afghanistan the last 20 years. Millions of Afghans have gone to school and become educated and, engaged, especially in the urban areas, that young, professional, educated Afghans have been engaging with the outside world through social media, discussing 21st century issues like human rights and gender equality and social justice and the environment. Millions and millions of cell phone users in Afghanistan. The country has really changed. Right now, the entire world is watching the Taliban. Every camera in the world is pointed at Afghanistan, but those cameras will be packed and those journalists will leave and the world will inevitably turn to some other corner and some other crisis will come up and Afghanistan will recede from the headlines. And the real question is, how will the Taliban behave then? If I had a message for President Biden, I would say what is done is done. You can't go back into Afghanistan now, but you can do some things. I think it isn't too much to say that America owes Afghan refugees that much to take in Afghan refugees, the people that we left behind in Afghanistan in the middle of the night. I would also ask President Biden to use his influence on international committee to exert diplomatic pressure on the Taliban to respect the essential human rights of all Afghan citizens, particularly women and girls, to not use intimidation and violence against its own citizens.
Khaled Hosseini, author of bestsellers including The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.